The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I am joined by Paul Hayes, founder of Beach Hut PR, Joan Burton, former Labour Minister, and Fiona Daly, Policy Communications and Government Affairs Specialist, to look at the stories making the news this weekend. And where we start is with an Ireland Thinks poll, and a huge amount of the Ireland Thinks poll in the Sunday Independent is dedicated to what people make of the speaking rights issue in the Dáil, headlined over Fionnuala Sheehan's piece, "Shoddy Treatment, Shabby Handling and a Grubby Deal." And the two sides of the argument seem to be boiling down to the government saying there is long established precedent that the opposition can say that they will provide confidence, supply, support, all the rest of it, and continue to be in opposition. Meanwhile, those on the other side of the house are saying, hang on a minute, you just negotiated the programme for government. You can't now join the opposition and hold the government to account. Joan Burton, who's right?
Well, I think the lawyers are probably going to have a bit of a field day whenever this case comes to court, because clearly there's long-standing practice. And I think most public servants, for instance, who are the people who are involved with the people who are elected and appointed to cabinet, are going to want to know what exactly is the situation going to be here. To be honest, I think there's just total confusion at the moment. And certainly the events of last week, I think there was a lot of re-row and rula-bula. And it sounds like there's a chance, a slim chance, that there might be more of that. I don't think that's good for the general health of democracy that we have these shows entertaining, you know, and interesting, I think, for a lot of journalists. But I think it just needs to calm down now. I think the other thing that hasn't received much attention in the papers, but I think everybody's been talking about, has been the storm and the aftermath. And I think everybody's been on the phone to friends and relations, particularly if they're living on the East Coast and they've, you know, they've people living in the West of Ireland. Because really, what emerged is we need to actually get the army in to
We can come to the storm in a while. And by the way, I think we're down to now about 45,000 people, the ESB saying that they have dragged it back from the 700,000 for the week started. As to the speaking row, though, has a Rubicon been crossed? Because in previous deals, there might have been an arrangement that said, we'll give you something to vote in favour of the government. Is it significantly different now that you have a cohort with an ostensible leader in the form of Michael Lowry actively negotiating the programme for government? Is that a different thing than we saw before with independent supports for government?
I think it's certainly raised it to a new level. And I think Michael Lowry is a very determined person. He's very able in terms of his understanding of parliamentary rules and, if you like, parliamentary practices. And I would say the government is probably a little bit unnerved by it, that it may simply lead to more scenes in the Dáil on a continuing basis. But at the same time, you have to take into account that Michael Lowry has effectively, if you like, enabled the government to be formed and enabled a Ciarán Cóirle to be appointed, the first woman Ciarán Cóirle in Irish history. And basically, Michael Lowry, I'd say, is loving all of this, while the government might be shaking a little bit in their boots to see what happens next. But, you know, people want the country to run and run properly. While the odd row is OK, a continuing series of them is very demeaning, if you like, of the Dáil's reputation.
Although it looks like if we look at what the poll is saying in the Sunday Independent, the opposition is incentivised to keep at this one. People were asked the question, do you think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael should be dealing with independent TD Michael Lowry in the light of the findings of the Moriarty Tribunal and his conviction for tax offences? Not exactly a leading question. And by party preference, everybody has a majority saying no, the government shouldn't be. But particularly when you get to the opposition, Sinn Féin supporters, 83% say they shouldn't. Green Party supporters, 84% say they shouldn't. Labour Party supporters, 84% say they shouldn't. A lot of incentive to keep this fight going, Paul, isn't there?
Oh, there really is. And as your occasional Tipperary correspondent, you know, I feel like I have huge local insight here. No, not really. It just seems like the smallest hill to die on. Like, I mean, I would take an interest. I don't think I've ever heard Michael Lowry speak in the Dáil. I definitely haven't heard of the three independents that are left that are going to be. So it seems like just a, you know, a procedural thing. They've lost the dressing room. The public are going, this is completely unfair. Whatever about the minutiae of the legal precedent and what might happen and everything else, they're at nothing, and the opposition are going to love this because it just seems like having your cake and eating it at a visceral level.
And from your perspective, do you, if you were calling who is right in the battle, do you take the view that says you can't be both poacher and gamekeeper and that's what this is? Or do you follow the precedent set by the Tony Gregors, the Jackie Healy Rays over the year, that this is fairly normal business?
It may well be the rules of the house, but I think most of the country is going to go, this is unfair.
Fiona Daly, your thoughts?
Well, look, I think both sides have to be really careful here. The poll may say that the public is on the side of the opposition, but Joan kind of touched on it earlier. The public really don't care about the technicalities of this, in my opinion. They don't care about who gets speaking time. They're paying attention because they're interested when they hear Larry's name, but they actually don't care. You know, if you're in rural Longford right now and you're cold and maybe you haven't had a shower for days, you don't actually care. You want them to get on with business. You know, Paul kind of touched on it. I do believe the opposition are right, but both sides are in trouble here. I mean, the government have drawn a line in the sand. The opposition are standing firm. When we talk about the opposition, what's interesting to me is we always talk about it as a unit, but it is fragmented. I mean, they disagree on things. They're not just one big party, but they're standing very firm on this, and they're not showing any sign of backing down. So if this goes to a vote, for example, it could result in huge backlash. I don't personally see how they're going to get out of this. I do see that there's going to be ruckus in the Dáil next week, and I think that's going to create a huge amount of anger with the public.
It's also only less than a month since, if you like, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael agreed to the nomination and the effective voting in of Michael Larry's selection to be Cian Chorla. So, you know, they gave with one hand and now they're kind of holding back. I'd say, you know, there's quiet smiles in certain quarters on how this is going.
A lot of the analysis is saying that it was a strategic error to get themselves into a position where they were seen to deal with Michael Lowry as kingmaker. Is that your view?
Well, I think Michael Lowry has a very long history in Irish politics. He's a very astute politician, but he also has various findings in relation to previous things that happened. And I think for a lot of people, while he may be hugely popular in his own home constituency, a lot of people disapprove. So I think a lot of the public would be very disappointed if this is not seen to be settled and settled in an appropriate way. It may also be, of course, as well, that the new Cian Chorla was in a bit of a pickle, given that the person who had been very involved in urging her appointment is now in the centre of a controversy. But of course, the Cian Chorla's job is solely just to run the business of the Dáil.
Did she make a hames of it on day one?
I don't think so, but I think she's on a steep learning curve, and I think she's probably getting a lot of advice both internally from officials and externally from people she knows. But at the same time, you know, if you take some of the people who've been independents, they've been very robust in presenting their views and finding ways of getting around their difficulties, and that's gone on in the Dáil now for well over 40 years, I'd say. So,
although I'm trying to think,
watch the spot.
I was watching it last week. I can't think of an instance where Cian Chorla has had a first day like that. Not blaming her for it, but just that experience of day one, first day in the job, mayhem.
Well, you see, I don't know, was she planning to become Cian Chorla, or did this all happen in a relatively quick period of time? But she certainly is on a steeply leaning learning curve. And for, you know, for everybody, I wish her the best, because we need a Cian Chorla who's able to operate in a functioning Dáil, and where, if you like, the traditions of parliamentary respect, which is to allow other people to speak as well as the speaker, are actually honoured.
Now, not only do we have attacks on the procedures within the Dáil, we have attacks about the makeup of cabinet, or those who are cabinet adjacent. Paul, the front page of the Sunday Times: the Attorney General set to lead a robust defence of super juniors. This is a legal action taken by Pat Daly, the Sinn Féin TD, who is saying that constitution allows for 15 cabinet ministers. By virtue of super juniors sitting around the table and throwing in their opinion, you've actually increased the cabinet to 165 or however many there are of them, and that's unconstitutional.
we're very good in this country at fudging things to get things by, and then it eventually, after a long period of time, hits a legal wall. So again, I think this is going to be one of these issues where, you know, and it's talking to Joan earlier, it's all Pat Rabbit's fault, I think we can say, as well, as the first Super Junior.
He was the first, because Prunches de Rossa would have been in cabinet alone. So you're in a room with 15 other people, plus the chief whip and so on. And Prunches de Rossa would have been there on his own. So in their wisdom, the Democratic left of the day felt that he needed a supporter, and he got one hell of a supporter in Pat Rabbit.
And now, just to remind, in case people haven't mired themselves in the technicality of a Super Junior, what a Super Junior effectively means, it created a position whereby somebody is able to go into the room, but they don't have a vote at cabinet. That's essentially it.
Broadly, but at the same time, the way the cabinet is organised in Ireland is that the cabinet is the cabinet, and we can't suddenly decide that instead of just being 15 people, plus in particular, you know, the principal assistant to the party leaders who are the chief whips, really. That's it. And it certainly during my time, and I'm not disclosing any cabinet secrets, let me be clear. But during my time, the people who were super juniors or juniors who may have attended at cabinet to bring and talk about a particular issue or a particular bill, it was all very polite and deferential. And it's up to the Taoiseach of the day, though, to command the cabinet. And it is up to the chief whips to arrange the business in a way that all of the parties in the cabinets, including if there are people who are independents, get their time. But well, generally that's done with great courtesy and, you know.
Well, this seems to be an issue because the level of courtesy is, the suggestion is that what it has created is effectively shadow cabinet ministers or proxy cabinet ministers. And part of the issue seems to be down to a column that Leo Varadkar wrote in the Sunday Times. Now, it's the Sunday Times who are saying this, so undoubtedly they're quite pleased. But nonetheless, they point out that Leo Varadkar says that the super juniors were treated as equals, had a full set of advisors and brought their own memos for decisions. He said that they were hamstrung by the current constitution, but they got around the rule of 15 by creating three super junior ministries with real and clearly defined responsibilities. If it waddles and quacks like a cabinet minister, it's a cabinet minister, isn't it?
Well, let's not forget as well, you know, a super junior minister, if they do get 45k salary top up as well. So that's not exactly going to make the public very happy if this case continues. The last time I find Pat Daly's case very, very interesting, because the last time I saw a case like this was Patrick Costello's most recent case with CETA, where the Supreme Court ruled on Patrick Costello's side. He took a case against the government and won. So it's not a case here where we can just expect, you know, the government to win this, that Pat Daly is an opposition and it's just been taken for, you know, image reasons or whatever. It's very interesting to see how this is going to progress. I'm watching closely.
In terms of the what we can read into the behaviour of the opposition, it seems to be an opposition more red in tooth and claw than that which preceded the election.
Yeah, I think they now know where the weak points are and what they're going to probe. But this strikes me as well, like the other topic that we just brought up, as irrelevant. As my understanding, again, I got it from Joan, is there very rarely are votes in cabinet. So actually what you're...
If there's a vote in cabinet, you're on a way to a general election.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't happen except once every 4 or 5 years, maybe, or when you want to bring something down. So it's the tail wagging the dog. It's inside baseball, and the Attorney General has to just sort it out one way or the other.
Hang on for a minute. Surely your argument, the premise that you're suggesting begs a different conclusion. If cabinet operated by voting purposes, then it would be insulated by virtue of only 15 people being able to make the decision.
Yeah.
If it operates by informal consensus, everybody in the room is treated as an equal if it is chaired in a consensus forum. That means that the super juniors operate as cabinet ministers.
No, that's, if I may say so, remember that cabinet ministers are appointed on the basis of what the constitution and the law provides for. The question with the super juniors is that we're moving into new territory where extra, if you like, powers are being found for them. Certainly in my memory in cabinet, you have to bear in mind that the lead minister is in charge of an entire department. Super juniors are generally attached to one or more departments, and it is the job, if you like, of both the minister in that department, the senior minister, and senior civil servants, that the super junior is allocated. I actually served as a Minister of State in the 1990s in the Department of Foreign Affairs, where I was Minister for Overseas Development.
But with no access to cabinet, or did you?
I had access to cabinet, but it was the leader, if you like, in the department at the time, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, was Dick Spring. And in fairness, I had a very, very large budget. I travelled to hotspots, particularly in Africa, because the genocide in Rwanda happened around the same time as the actual first elections in South Africa, which were big issues of interest to people in Ireland and Europe at the time. And it just has to be done, if you like, with a certain amount of propriety and decorum. But if you were to have super juniors who were coming in and who were, say, so strong that they were actually stronger than the cabinet ministers, I think then you'd be running into trouble, because it is a constitutional function that the cabinet makes decisions, important decisions about spending money and so on. It might be as well in the current kind of thing with the regional independence that they may be particularly focused on the particular areas of their own region and particular projects that they have an interest in. Now, it's for the Taoiseach of the day and for the other members of the cabinet to try and ensure that there's a fair deal for everybody in the country. Whereas, as I say, strong independents may be very interested, understandably, there's nothing wrong with it, and represent really well the areas that they've been elected for. But you have to have a balance between the two, and you have to maintain the constitutionality of the cabinet.
The text saying public cares about this. Outside of the technicalities that public may be not interested in, we are interested in the perception of the new government. It looks shady and a throwback to the days of the nod and wink politics of the 20th century. I, for one, am delighted that the opposition stood up to this, and I am your classic swinging voter for transparency, says the end of the text. 53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. Coming up, we'll talk about those tariffs that the Trump administration brought in to an immediate response from Canada, from Mexico and from China. And we'll look at the new speed limits that are coming in Ireland this Friday. And on the front of the Business Post is a PR-related story, Paul, because the Irish executives in the US are being drafted in to battle Trump trade threat. This is the fear that Donald Trump is going to turn on us. He may, but he's busy at the minute. He has just started a trade war with Canada and with Mexico and China, and Justin Trudeau has been very strong in the Canadian response.
I think we'll keep our head down in this one while the big boys battle it out, and then we're hopefully running under the radar a little bit. I think he's getting ahead of himself there, or we are, thinking that execs from the tech world are going to come in and protect us. I think initially they're going to do it out of self-interest. They're not going to do it out of joining some government, you know, task force. Eventually, though, if you look at it, Trump knows where his bread is buttered, and it's MAGA. And ultimately, he's going to cut the tech guys off, because he's done it already. The Port of Los Angeles was meant to automate, which would be a very tech-focused thing. He said, once the longshoremen said they were going on strike, he said, these men can't be put out of work, and they cut them. So that's before Musk gets into self-driving cars and trucks and everything else. And then Vivek Vereshwamy, I think, who was the candidate for a while and was part of the Doge office, or Dodge office, depending where, as soon as he brought up H-1B visas and foreign talent, cut, done. So I don't think the tech guys are as stable as they think they are, and a lot of our tech guys as well wouldn't necessarily be predisposed to the Irish government's view on where he's going anyway. So, yeah, it's going to be difficult.
And how soon do you think before the Trump administration's attention turns to us?
I think we're going to be okay for a while, not least of all because, you know, Doonbeg is there and he loves it so much. But I also think we're slightly different to Europe and even to the UK in that, you know, if he lowers, and again, I'm getting off my area of expertise, but if he gets out of the OECD and lowers, we could become tax collectors for him. It's actually deferred. It depends on how much he wants to repatriate profits as opposed to where it gets to. We are kind of the 51st state still. And I think at a simplistic level, we can convince him of that with a few little twists and turns.
What do you make, Joan, of the tariff war that's brewing? I mean, we now have tariffs, Canada slapping tariffs on for white goods, for beer, for bourbon, for cars, so Ford, Chevy, all the rest of it. That's, I mean, it is not obviously the biggest single market, but it's up there from the US perspective.
Well, let's see what happens in terms of Canada, Mexico and China. I don't think that they will just sit tight on the whole thing, and let's see how it's actually implemented. I think the whole thing about Ireland and the United States is that, first of all, we have this strong advantage of being an English-speaking country that's a member of the European Union, one of the few, although most people in Europe have English now as their second language. So that's a tremendous advantage. And I'd say it's a huge advantage to Mr. Trump as well, should he come, because we have long links with America. However, I think we're going to have to keep very well briefed on this.
But hang on for a minute. We know that members of the Trump administration have said, and I'm paraphrasing, but only by much, things are manufactured in China, then they magically find their way to Ireland and they pay 3% tax on them, and then they are sold in vast bulk. Whether or not that is true, it is an insight into the way they think. As far as the administration is concerned, we are a brass plaque that is washing intellectual property and money through here at vast profits that should be going to the US.
Well, the government has already now set up a kind of a consultative group that's based largely in the United States, which is going to look at this. But I would imagine from the point of view of the major tech companies, they would not, for a variety of reasons, wish to lose Ireland. Does it mean that it couldn't ever happen? Well, anything can happen. And I think what the government needs to do, and I think in creating the group in the United States who are going to watch events there and maybe just talk truth to power, that this is what's actually happening as opposed to what the chat is happening. I think that's a key one. But I also think as well that there is a warmth. I myself, like lots of other people in Ireland, I worked as a student in the States. I've been back and forward to the States over a long period of time. There is a very warm relationship between the United States and Ireland. And I think we should just play our cards to just be there. We've some very good diplomats representing Ireland in recent years. And
I think those diplomats, Joan, need to talk to sane people, and he's not sane. So I think they'll do beneath the radar. I have this theory that what we should do is assemble an Avengers squad of golfers, because Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry live about half an hour north of Mar-a-Lago. And right now, McGregor and Dana White and Joe Rogan have his ear. If you look at Irish people, we need to go on the charm and transactional
and
side.
And for non-golfers, we can also say, come to Ireland and walk the beach in Dunbeg. It's absolutely beautiful and you don't need to know anything about golf. It'll be happening up on top of the in the drum.
And where do we balance morality and right and wrong in all of this?
His forgiving of some of the fascists on January 6th, I think, was the bridge that will eventually come back to bite him, because that was probably the most disgusting thing a US president has done since the Civil War.
But I think again about the Patrick's Day thing that we regard as, and it is a jewel in the crown in terms of economic diplomacy, but there is one where we are hoping that the Taoiseach will have an opportunity to give what is perceived as our national imprimatur to the new administration. Should we have any pause in that, or are we just delighted?
Well, the question came up, I think, about a week ago, will we even get an invitation this year? So I presume we are going to get an invitation, but this conversation comes up every single year. Should we go? Should we not? This is soft politics. It's really important for us to go. If we don't, if we back out of this, somebody else will happily take our place. You know, Donald Trump, he is the president of the United States now, whether we like it or not. The US is Ireland's biggest economic partner. Over 800 US companies operate in Ireland, employing around 190,000 people. We can't just suddenly say, oh, we're not going. Somebody else will just take our place instead. It's not a smart move.
Also, the EU has the trade competency. We don't get to speak to it. So even if Simon Harris adds trade to his foreign affairs or Micheál Martin goes there, the most important Irish politician is probably going to be Pascal Donoghue if he gets re-elected as head of the European finance ministers as president, because that's the level you can see now. You know, he hasn't put tariffs on Europe yet, but it's coming, and it's at that level the fight will happen.
I think, though, there was something inappropriate about the dominance of the tech brothers at the actual inauguration. Mm. It was a very clear statement by Trump, who knows how to talk to people, to say to the people looking in at his inauguration, these are the people who matter to me. Now, as it happens, those people are also the people who have a lot of investments in Ireland. So I think there's a lot of road to run on this, but Ireland does have to be very, very astute and careful. And certainly having, you know, gone to America for a number of St. Patrick's Day events, it's enormously popular in the States itself. It's basically a spring national holiday that coincides with the holidays from colleges and universities and so on. And it's worth its weight in gold, really, to Ireland. But also, we have to, and we know how many Irish or people of Irish descent there are in the States. And like Italians, the Irish are very proud of their heritage.
Are they still significant as a voting bloc, though, or is that waning very
quickly? Well, I don't know if the voting blocs work in quite the way where people lived in a neighbourhood that was Irish or Italian or Greek or Latino. I don't know that it works that way anymore. But certainly the Irish are there, they're influential, but also they're very proud of their Irish history.
Just before we move on, the other thing that's interesting about the tech bros that you listed as the sort of the five or six that were there, it was interesting, I think it was John Stewart who made the point of how much of the world's discourse was controlled by the six people in that group, because you had the head of Google, which provides a search to almost the entire planet. You're the owner of the Wall Street Journal. You had the prime mover and largely owner of Meta, and you had the owner of Twitter. That combination, that's pretty much the world's media.
Yeah, and they are interventionalists. They are not old school press barons who might have put their thumb on the scales every now and again. These guys are out there doing it on purpose. I mean, X or Twitter has turned into a cesspit. It is disgusting what's on there. We're hanging on by a thread. There's also a problem here that we're kind of taking our eye off the ball. We're past peak globalization. Trump's almost a symptom of that. Like the 70 million Irish diaspora, the vast majority of them voted for Trump. We wouldn't necessarily, in terms of where the political needle is in Ireland, recognise who they are. But they're my cousins and they're my friends and they're where they're at. There's also a problem in that the UK, the British ambassador is writing today about start building, not digging, you know, in the UK. We need to stand on our own two feet now because, you know, it is past peak globalisation. If the UK goes into the IMF, and I hope I didn't just start a run on the pound, although that would be cool, you know, we're going to be in much more trouble than whatever happens globally with the other tariffs even because of the amount of trade and export and everywhere else.
I think we also have to bear in mind as well that we're significant members of the European Union. And
significant?
Yes, we are. We might be very small, but we count a lot, and we have all this American trade, as have a number of other European countries, and they would certainly like more. But I think we should just keep in mind that we are members of the European Union, and the European Union has a very significant bilateral relationship as the Union with America. So I think, you know, Mr. Trump may very well, or President Trump may very well be very difficult to deal with. But on the other hand, there are a lot of other things that are quite positive in Ireland's place, but we need to use them all.
53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. We'll move to matters closer to home, because on Friday, February 6th, this is according to a huge ad, a half-page ad in the Business Post. It has, of course, been mentioned prior to that. We are going to be getting new speed limits. So speed limits on local roads are going to be reduced from 80 kilometres an hour to 60 kilometres an hour. And the government ad says, as speed contributes to a third of fatal collisions, these new speed limits greatly reduce the risk of death, which is an assertion their own report doesn't make. In fact, it makes the opposite. Interesting to see them making it in print. What's your view on the speed limits being dropped?
Well, look, the research does show that a reduced speed limit does reduce deaths. I believe at 60 kilometres an hour, its survival rate is only 50%. At 80 kilometres per hour, it's 10%. So research does show that this works. I think from my point of view, post-COVID, something has happened on the roads. There's been an increased aggression. There's been almost this normalisation of bad driving. And I think what they're trying to do is tackle it in any way possible. But this word always comes up of enforcement, enforcing the speed limits. I don't think people realise that if the speed limit is 60 kilometres an hour, that doesn't mean that you have to reach 60 kilometres per hour. It just means that that is the max you should go. People seem to think that that means you should drive at 60 kilometres per hour. So for me, I'm glad they're doing something, but it will be about enforcement here, and we're not great in this country at enforcing our legislation. We're kind of good at bringing it forward, but we're not great at following through and enforcing.
Paul?
Well, I read your own column on it this morning, and I think it's interesting, but it doesn't go far enough, which is, you know, you outlined what the problem is. It's 4 out of 5 males. It's, you know, it's, and then of those, 3 are drink related, and, you know, speed obviously comes into it, but it's probably the third thing. But we do know that it's very dangerous to the people that you hit, the speed you hit the mat. And there is a, and you talked about A/B testing, technology's there. Every car sold in the last 5 years in Europe now has speed restrictors brought in. And as much as it goes against my civil libertarian views, I think if young males with testosterone and drink and bad cars and speeding and bad roads in certain areas of the country, I think we could actually restrain them. I mean, insurance tried to do it by upping their insurance, but I think speed limits and everything else, you know, it's after the fact almost, because you have to, a number of confluence of things have to come. I think you could restrict speed in any car for any under 27-year-old. You can now, you know, breathalyzers can be fitted to cars. If we truly wanted to do this, we can do it. The technology is there. Also, we're about 3 to 5 years, much as I disparage Musk, you know, he has been the most progressive on it, as I take a sip from my Tesla water bottle. We can get to the point where accident prevention technology effectively means self-driving within 5 years.
And why not tackle the core problem, that being male behaviour? Because if you look at female contribution to road deaths, yeah, it's what? It's 20%? Less
yeah.
than that?
Yeah, and almost always drink-related, actually, rather than speed. But that's what I think. I think you actually take the insurance data and restrict them through the technology right now for their own good. And when they get beyond it, I know there'll be workarounds and there'll be everything else, but that would be much more effective. But the speed, unfortunately, it's a catch-all solution, and it does work, but it's not perfect.
Well, I think one of the things we need to do is that we need to bring the campaign local, because there's a lot of people even today who'll be visiting graveyards of beloved relatives, and anybody who's been affected in their family or their friends with the horrifying injuries that an accident causes. I think we should probably all know a little bit more about that. I also think as well, though, that the campaigns should be local, and they should also include the pubs in the locality where there's, you know, there's advertising and information to say, look, if you're thinking of drinking more than X number of drinks, please don't, because you may hit somebody and kill yourself or kill somebody else or injure them for life on the way home. I think that responsibility has to be said. It's one thing to have advertising which mourns the horrible number of deaths and injuries on the road. I think it's another to try and switch that to saying, look, this is all our personal responsibility, whether we're just going to the shops or we're driving the country, you know, to do it. And I just think that that needs a rethink.
But in terms of personal responsibility, if we have 1/3 of drivers who are killed on the road being drunk, that's not a general issue.
But that's what I'm saying. That campaign also needs to be in pubs, so that in the pub you're reminded that, listen, if you're stacking up to have had 6 or 7 drinks, you are not a fit person to drive. And say, if you're thinking of driving, don't. We can get you a taxi, get your car in the morning.
As the son of a Tipperary publican, I've seen that. I've seen the posters that, you know, saw Eamon Ryan wanted for crimes against rural, alongside the increased frequency of the local link bus. So there wasn't a lot of that. But the problem is, yeah, you cannot get a taxi. We need to deregulate taxis outside of Dublin so that people can actually Uber-like.
I think get the question home of the public transport is a huge issue. There isn't enough of it in rural Ireland. And even in Dublin, we have an awful lot more buses that are going through the night. And so younger people, because a taxi, you know, from the centre of any city to, say, 10 miles away, it's pretty expensive in terms of young people's budgets. You know, it's going to be at least probably 20 quid.
But the reality is we have 4 out of 5 of the people who are killed, drivers who are killed, are men. They're young men, and 1/3 of them are drunk. And that's not a blanket speed limit issue. That is a male behavioural issue.
Yeah, but, you know, we as a country at one stage had a huge amount of domestic violence. Domestic violence now is a no-go. It still happens, and we still have to have very strong campaigns against it. But it's not almost something which is taken casually for granted by a section of people, whereas people in pubs, unless they're reminded, look, your drinking is hitting the danger spot, stop, or get a taxi home.
A lot of response. I understand why the speed limit in villages, schools, towns is 50 kilometres is too fast. In our villages, I've seen elderly people running across the roads to avoid being knocked down. All over Europe, it's 30 kilometres an hour. What's the delay? Another, the reduction in speeds is just going to irritate honest drivers. Young men need to be tracked. It's simple. Another, the reduction in speed limits will increase commuting times and will result in pressurised drivers taking more back roads and rat runs.
Rory Sutherland, who's a great marketeer, has this great thing where he said, you know, for younger people especially, we shouldn't have speedometers in cars. We should have time to destination. And I've noticed this. If you speed, you save about a minute on a 30-minute journey. It's not worth it. It's basically, if you didn't get parking when you get there, it doesn't matter anyway. But our perception is, me going 130 on the motorway versus 110 is huge when it's minuscule. We actually need to change speedometers in cars.
Although the report in this instance will say that all journey times will go up thanks to this. Anton, my wife and I live in a small seaside town in Wexford and walk every day. The whole area is designated 50 kilometres an hour. Drivers are reckless and nobody abides by the speed limit. Changes to 30. This decision is an expensive joke as it will not change behaviour. Another, the amount of single vehicle accidents needs to be recorded separately. A lot of these take place at night and no speed limit changes will sort this out. That goes to male behaviour.
And there also needs really to be more speeding. Pedestrian infrastructure so that if you are in that village, there's a couple of places where pedestrians can safely walk across the middle of Main Street.
Also, traffic does flow more evenly and faster when there's less stopping and starting. Acceleration and deceleration fast creates queuing theory. I'm a nerd for this. Everyone can go. The average speed in Dublin is 12 kilometres an hour, by the way. So I don't know where you're getting, you know, even getting to 30.
You're sitting at a traffic light for 10 minutes in a, you know, in a 20-minute journey.
It's all about flow.
Interesting story in the Mail saying the HSE bans treatment for patients who raise cash through crowdfunding. And in essence, what this seems to be is, if there is a drug for your condition, which is not provided, if I'm reading the story correctly, which is not provided through the state coffers, if you arrive with a fistful of cash to a state hospital and say, I will fund this myself, the answer is no, you will not. You cannot get it through the public system, even if you're willing to pay the cost yourself. Can you see the logic of this, Paul?
Not really. I mean, I understand qual years and that there's only a set amount of money that can be spent for everyone. And it has to be, I mean, government is about compromise between all of us. So I can understand that. But actually banning you from buying or accessing the drug, I thought that would have been a good thing. It takes it out of the, it adds to the qual years for everyone. Maybe there's some kind of administrative reason, but we're going through such a revolution in healthcare at the moment, you know, with immunotherapy versus, you know, other cancer treatments that seem to be so much more progressive. You know, mRNA and vaccine is going so fast. AI has advanced cancer treatments so fast now. I think this might be short-sighted, but maybe I'm not seeing the whole picture.
Well, it's interesting because they're quoting in the story saying that the reason that the HSE doesn't reimburse quickly is the cost of drugs. So if the HSE hasn't put this onto the schedule that's available, but they quote Dr. Michael McCarthy, Acting Secretary of the Irish Medical Society of Oncology, saying, I have a patient who I referred to a private hospital for immunology treatment and it has worked very well and she's 18 months into it now and our cancer is controlled. I had a public patient before Christmas who didn't have insurance, so I couldn't access that drug. There's a big difference in how long people live. That public patient is no longer with us. That's an extraordinary thing in Ireland, Joan, isn't it? I mean, that's the kind of thing you expect in America. You're dead because you couldn't afford the drug.
Well, it's something very sad because it means that what the doctor is saying in the interview is that it's the money that counts. And that if you don't have access to a very significant amounts of money, because as people were saying here, there's been tremendous improvements in cancer treatments and other treatments in recent times. I mean, they're miraculous, actually, compared to what people used to go through 20 or 30 years ago. So I think, again, this might be something that should be on the wish list and the hit list of the new government.
Do you see the logic because from the government perspective? Because they may say, look, we can't have a situation where people are arriving with crowdfunded fistfuls of cash to buy medicines that aren't already on our schedule.
I think you're looking at this from the wrong angle. The angle is that people should be able to access the best drugs that are suitable for their condition, and then we as a country will sort out the funding. And this is why we need to look at our health service and ensure that if, say, people of lesser means are getting lesser opportunities in terms of treatment, that would be really sad and contrary to all of the longer traditions of Irish medicine.
That's a bit utopian, though, isn't it? We still have pharmacoeconomics.
Yeah,
you still still make the balance on what's worth paying for.
You have to have some principles. If you're looking at a four-year-old child and one is the child of, say, fairly well-off parents, or another is the child of parents who have, say, health insurance, and another is the child of parents who don't have any of these, you're really saying that child number three is going to get little or nothing in terms of the available treatment. I think that's absolutely ghastly.
But we did have a different, you know, I would often see fundraisers to send a child to the States because only the surgery exists there. This is the, if it's crowdfunded, everyone has the same amount of money. You know, it tends to be that if you are less well off socioeconomically, most of us couldn't afford novel or orphan drugs. Like, no matter how rich you are, there's probably only 10 people in the country that could afford it. So, I mean, this goes back to Brian Lenihan being sent to get his liver done in the States, and that was crowdfunded by Charlie Hoy, but that's another day in the bog.
And that was crowdfunded for Charlie
Hoy. Indeed. But, like, where do we go to from... There's also a thing of the trickle-down of innovation. The more people you can get on these things quicker, the more it tends to be better for the tribe. So, I don't know, it's troubling.
Interesting text in relation to the speed limits we were talking about earlier. Norway and Sweden have Europe's lowest road fatality rates thanks to their Vision Zero strategy, which prioritises safe infrastructure, strict speed management and strong law enforcement. Unlike Ireland, they don't rely solely on speed limits. Instead, they invest heavily in road design and safety measures, which are key to their...
And public transport.
And fine you based on your income.
Indeed. I believe I think the record speeding fine was for a senior executive in Nokia, wasn't it?
Yeah, what a humble brag.
Yeah.
It cost me £1 million to go over that.
I think, it was 130,000 euro equivalent or something that he got for breaking the speed limit. Another one saying, I don't drink in our family, so I put myself forward to be the designated driver to collect family and friends. If every family did that, would help. I would wonder, and this goes back to your point, Joan, about the domestic violence thing, about what is social norms. I wonder, is drink driving creeping back in? Because 5 or 10 years ago, it seems to the attitude, maybe it is the lack of because the speed check, not speed checks, the breath testing isn't what it once was. I wonder, is it getting slightly normalised?
Well, you see, I think the other thing as well is that, and lots of people have commented on it, Gardaí are fairly scarce on the streets. Mm. And if you have, particularly in a rural town, a couple of local guards who are around as the pubs close and so on, that can have a tremendously sobering effect and lead to decisions that the person who hasn't been drinking should drive
also
the car.
Also, drug driving, I would imagine, and is almost
and
a car now.
Drugs are a major
problem. Because it's done privately, it's not as socially, you know, even overseen.
Oh, yeah, when you look at, I think the longitudinal study had additional drugs, so cocaine, benzodiazepines, marijuana, something to the order of 20% of fatal collisions. Yeah. The driver had that in the system. I think that's what the numbers are. Anyway, Paul Hayes, founder of Beach Hut PR, Joan Burton, former Labour Minister, Fiona Daly, Policy Communications and Government Affairs Specialist. Thank you all very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.